So we're taking up some inyanim pertaining to the Haggadah. The question has been raised about the use of illustrations in the conduct of the Seder. It's interesting, you find a lot of Haggadahs that do have illustrations and so on and so forth. Well, is there any point to it? Is there any problem with it? Or even if there's no problem, is there any benefit to it? And so on and so forth. Now, in Perek Zayin of Hilchos Chametz Matah, where the Rambam talks about the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Rambam mentions that incorporated within the obligation of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is Vehigar Telavincha, to teach one's child, to teach one's son. And then the Rambam says, Mitzvah lo di lobanim, it's a mitzvah to inform the children, V'yafilu lo shalu, and even if they didn't ask. So that's an interesting point. Asking is very important, though. Everything that we're doing revolves around stimulating people to ask questions, because that's an insight into the whole philosophy of education. That in Judaism recognizes the significance of stimulating questions. Judaism is unique and it's different in that it encourages people to ask, to question. And yet, the way things have developed, there's no religion that's like that. All religions are not based upon that. Well, all religions don't mind questions, but not in terms of the axioms, not in terms of the basics. That is, up to a certain point, you accept it. Now, once you accept it, the system, so then within that system, you could ask all the questions and so on. So everybody feels very safe. You know, you can give an answer. But to challenge the actual foundations of the system itself, no, I don't think any religion is prepared to deal with that. That's
the
it.
Muslims would consider that.
That's heresy.
Heresy.
That's right. So really, not only wouldn't they deal with it, but you're considered to be wicked for asking those kinds of questions. And it's severely discouraged. And you see from the Seder night to the Kai, even the Russia, the question of the Russia. And a person should be prepared to deal with it and to be able to show the flaws. That is, the whole purpose of the evening is to demonstrate that in order to arrive at a proper acceptance of Judaism, it has to be through study, through understanding, through dealing with all kinds of questions. It seems to me we've drifted very far from that, because basically the way it's done in most of the yeshivas is the same, pretty much the same thing, in that you could ask questions, but these questions are you accept the basics of the system. So now, how does this work? Why is this halacha contradiction? Very nice, great questions. But if you're going to start to probe into the underlying reasons, then you're going to meet, in most cases, you're going to meet a lot of resistance. If you're stimulating people to ask questions, then you can't get upset when they ask you questions. Mm-hmm. It's true that the person who's leading the Seder has a responsibility to be prepared, but as best as he can. I mean, you may encounter a question that you can't answer. That shouldn't stop the whole situation. That's a good question, and it's stimulus for further thought. We're not concerned about that type of thing, that there's a question that's going to blow us out of the water. Now, the Rambam says, Lefidaito shel ben aviv melamdo, that the father teaches him in accordance with his ability. The question one has to ask on that is, of course, as opposed to what? What's he teaching us here? That in accordance with the understanding of the child, you teach him. How can you teach him not in accordance with his understanding? In terms of teaching him beyond his level, that I don't think you needed the Rambam, because that's not teaching. If he's not prepared, it would seem if he's not prepared, although that's something to be cognizant of. That's something one should be cognizant of. It's absurd to say, you know, that you shouldn't teach someone beyond his level. But nevertheless, practically speaking, sometimes a person might do that. Sometimes a person might teach him above his level, or try to. Which means that you have to be in sync with the level of the child. You may be too lazy, let's put it that way. Or let's say that you can explain the story, but you're explaining it for adults. But to take the trouble to break it down for a child, that's not so simple. And A, it's not so simple, and you don't really enjoy that. So, you know, if you just tell it over to the child, but it's beyond his level, he gets something out of it, but he doesn't fully understand it. That's what I think. In other words, it's got to be tailor-made to the level of the child. That is, it shouldn't be, and on the other hand, it shouldn't be too childish either. Because if he has the capability of understanding more, then you should give him more. That's what I think he's saying. L'fidaito shel ben. In other words, it's not just a perfunctory thing. Okay, we told the story and that's it. Let's move on. It should be in accordance with his level, not too advanced. That is, of course, if you're talking in a manner he doesn't know what you're talking about, then that's he didn't have to tell you. If you're going to get up there and speak in sophisticated terminology like you would in a seminar or whatever for advanced students, and he can't even follow you, that goes without saying you don't do. But you can say it in a way where he gets some sense of it, but it's not really tailor-made to him. It's tailor-made for a different audience. So that's what I think it has to be. It has to be tailor-made for him, which means it's not beyond his level, because then he doesn't get the full impact. But also, it shouldn't be below his level. That is, you should try, hopefully bring him to the highest level of appreciation that he can attain. Ketzad, how so? Im hoya katan o tipesh. If the child was young, minor, or tipesh, means he wasn't that bright. Omer lo, he says to him, Bini, my son, kulanu hayinu avadim, all of us were slaves, kamo shifcha zu, o kamo eved ze. Now, what do you mean? Like this female servant or like this male slave? Slave, like a slave, so to speak. Now, that, what do you mean like this? Which one is he talking about? He assumes that in the house you have servants. So then, what do you see from that? That if the child needs an illustration, it's helpful, it's useful. Now, he's talking about where there's a live person, because it's easier to understand. But I would extrapolate from this that why does it have to be only a live person? Why can't you show pictures in a book of what slaves? You take a picture of what slaves and so on and so forth till he grasps the point. Uvalayla hazeh, and on this night, Poda osanu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God redeemed us, v'yotzienu l'cheres, and took us out to freedom. So the Rambam, I believe, is pointing out what would be the minimal requirements in order to, that is, if a child is not on this level, then you're exempt. If you have a child that's not advanced enough to understand this, then you're exempt. But the minimal, this is the minimal sipur, would be the child is capable of understanding the idea of a slave and also being free, being freed from slavery by Hashem. That's the minimal sipur. Yimhoya haben gadol v'chacham, and if he was advanced and wise, Modio Mashi'ir Alana b'Mitzrayim, he informs him of what happened to us in Mitzrayim, V'nisim Shenasu Lanu, and the miracles that were done for us, Ayidei Moshe Rabbeinu, through Moshe Rabbeinu, Hakol Lufidaita Shel Ben, all in accordance with his level. So he's really supposed to enter into a discussion, a learning session. That's the essential Seder, really, is the communication, the discussion, the learn. It's a learning session between the father and the son, in accordance with the level of the son. Take a look at the next Rambam. The next point, the Rambam talks about the shinuyim, that you're supposed to make changes to get the attention of the child, to stimulate him to ask, why is this night different? So I'm just repeating a point. I made this point yesterday. The Rav makes this point in the Haggadah, that really, ideally, the child would not be scripted. That this is one area that should be left for the night of Pesach, and it should be done father to son, as opposed to being completely prepared and saturated with material in school. So by the time the night comes, there's nothing spontaneous that's going to happen. All right, so we're just going to go through certain parts of the Haggadah. Now, after you have the karpas. The karpas, as we said, is basically to make the change, the shinui. Mm-hmm. if you take a look at, well, I have it in the Haggadah I'm using, that some instructions here. This is also, he takes the karpas. He says less than a kazayas. And then he dips it in the salt water, makes the bar priyadama. Now, when you make the bar priyadama for the karpas, you also have in mind for the moror, the bar priyadama for the moror. And the moror, it's not necessary, you know, because it's after the motzi and all that. So anything else in the meal that's incorporated into the meal would be, you would need a bracha for. But that's the question, whether the maror is really part of the meal, or you're eating it for the mitzvah, it's not really part of the meal. So to avoid any kind of problem, when you make the bar priyadama for the karpas, so have in mind that this bar priyadama should also apply to the maror you'll be eating later on. And he mentions that there are those who, the gra held that you should eat a kazayas of karpas, based upon the Rama. He mentions that ein tzarich lahasev, you don't have to do recline. However, according to the Avudraham, you do have to recline. After that, you have the yachat, the breaking of the matzah. So that's very, very important. That's part of the idea that the Haggadah is recited over the matzah. That gets back to the point we mentioned before. The phenomenon of illustration. I mean, the Seder is geared so that the story should be told on different levels. One is just purely discussion. But then you have actions that you do to illustrate freedom. Mm-hmm. The matzah itself is a sign, an expression of geula. That's why we have to explain the kind later on, matzah zu she'anu ochlin, and so on. So at the very time that you're discussing the story, you're also in the presence of the objects, of the mitzvos that emerged as a result of what took place. Then you have the manishtana. Now, concerning the manishtana, there's a difference of opinion. Is this the question of the sun? Or no, it's not the question of the sun. Or put a different way, does everybody have to recite the manishtana? Now, I think in most households, you have the son or the youngest one asks the manishtana. However, the Rav holds, based on the Rambam, that the manishtana is not the question of the child. And for very good reason. For very good reason, because if we just got finished saying that you have to teach the story and stimulate questions, and each according to the level of the child, so how is it that every child in the universe is going to ask the same four questions? That's what the Rav says. The Rav says you can't foresee what kind of question a child will ask. Oh. He says that the manishtana is not intended to be the question of the child. Rather, it's not a question. It's a statement. It's sort of like manishtana. How different is this night? It's a proclamation. The matzah has a dual personality, so to speak. And that is that in the Halach Ma'anya, we refer to the matzah as the bread of the poor, the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in Egypt. So that would indicate that due to their poverty, they couldn't afford really good bread, so they would eat matzah. However, later on when we talk about the matzah, before we eat the matzah, we talk about the al shuma, for what's the reason? Is because of the haste that God appeared, so to speak, and redeemed with great haste. So then the matzah is the expression of the redemption. So it's very, very interesting that the matzah is as a dual identification. Interestingly enough, it seems to be two opposites. It's interesting, too, that at the outset, when you're designating the matzah, halach ma'anya, that's the matzah that you're telling the story over. So that's the matzah of the Avdus. Because the story is really the story of Avdus, of how we were slaves. And, well, of course, it's how how we attained our freedom. But the whole story of attaining the freedom presupposes that you were slaves. But the mitzvah, I say, of eating matzah, that is the geula. The mitzvah is the geula. The mitzvah is not the enslavement. The enslavement is just a means to an end. I would say, by way of drush, so to speak, that it's not a problem that one object should have two opposite meanings. Okay. Because there's a connection between the two. And that is that there's a purpose for the enslavement. That it served a purpose in purifying the Jews, so to speak, in separating them from the lifestyle of the Egyptians, that it was necessary. It was necessary for them to experience the slavery. Without the slavery, then they could not have ever achieved their freedom. Because the, you know, Chazal mentioned that the Medrash, that God offered the Torah to the other nations, and that each one of them raised an objection, what about this? Adultery, what about that, you know, and so on. So they rejected it. Look, to me, the basic idea is that all the nations of the world rejected the Torah because they viewed it as a impediment, as a restriction on their freedom, because they had a false idea of freedom, instinctual freedom. So the idea of being restrained in terms of my instincts, which at first glance, that's what the Torah appears to be. I can't eat what I want to eat. I can't just follow my desires, my lusts, my emotions, right? I can't even, on Shabbos, I can't, I want to go for a drive. So at first glance, it appears to be something which is antithetical to human freedom. But the truth of the matter is, it's not the case. It's really something which liberates you from an enslavement to your instincts. So it's only when a person's in a situation of avdus, when a person is in a situation, it's an irony of life. That when a person is free, he destroys his own freedom. He can't appreciate the freedom because he then gets caught up in pursuing all of his desires. And he thinks that he's free, but he's losing his freedom all the time because now he's a slave to his needs and his desires. So in that state of mind, he's chasing his illusions. And if you try to reason with him, he's not going to listen to you. But it's only when a person trips up, so to speak, gets caught up in some kind of scam, and then this whole thing comes crashing down, then he's off in jail, and he's cut off from all the other things, then he regrets, he realizes that he was... And then, if you open up a Gemara or a Sefer and you learn, and then he can appreciate the beauty of an idea. And it's an irony. And then he looks back and he says, what a fool I was. I was chasing after illusions, and I could have had... This is real. That's the idea over here. That there is, due to the nature of man, there is a connection between the avdus and the chavrus. That it's only after they went through that experience of being deprived of the opportunity to just pursue whatever they want. A slave doesn't have that opportunity. He has all these desires, but he can't satisfy them. So then he's willing to listen to a different philosophy of life. That the real good is something which does not depend upon the physical, but really it's within yourself. To if you can activate thinking and learning and ideas, that's what your real nature is. That's the real good. So Halach Ma'anya is the beginning of the story, but the affliction, but it ends with the geula, and that's why God intervened. The God didn't just intervene because we were enslaved and so forth. It's because there was a purpose that apparently, as a result of what they had experienced, the Jews were ready to remove themselves from Egypt and to accept the Torah. If they're not willing to accept the Torah, so then just to get them out of Egypt would have been meaningless. They wouldn't have been any different than the Egyptians. So that was the objective, and that was the idea, that God timed it, and then God redeemed them from that, so that experience is one which has the responsible for their liberation as well. Then you have the Manishtana. Here I'm going to quote again from the Rav Zagara. He says that Manishtana can be understood as a single affirmative statement. That is, how different is this night from all of the nights? So Manishtana does not necessarily mean it's a question. That the statement of Manishtana can be an affirmative statement. Not how, like you're asking a question, but no, as a statement, how different this is. Similar to the phrase, Manorah HaMakom HaZeh, that you find, that was when Yaakov, when he slept and he took a stone, and then he had the vision, the Nevuah, and he says, Manorah, how wondrous is it? It was a statement, it wasn't a question. Taken as an affirmative statement, Manishtan is akin to the declaration made before performing a mitzvah. Hineni muchan u'mezuman. I am ready to fulfill the mitzvah of Pesach, Matzah, Mar, and Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. But basically, whether you take it as a question or you take it as a statement, well, what is the content of the, what's the four? What are these four statements? So these four statements delineate, in other words, you're talking about the difference of this night. That's the mitzvah of Sipur, is to recognize how this night is different and unique through the mitzvahs of the night. The difference is incorporated into the mitzvahs. So the classification, that is, on all nights we eat chametz and matzah, on this night only matzah. So basically the first difference is the prohibition of chametz, and the focus, the matzah, the mitzvah of matzah. Now, what's the significance of the second question? Or the second statement, whatever. That on all nights we eat the other vegetables. On this night, moror. By the way, on this night you can eat other vegetables too. There's no proscription on vegetables. But it means to say that you must eat moror. Another way of putting it would be on all other nights we can eat whatever vegetables we want. On this night, we can do that, but we must eat moror. So what's the point of that? On all of the nights, we don't even dip once. Tonight, we have two dippings. Now, the two dippings is the child. That's for the sake of the child, to get the child involved. That's the mitzvah of Vigarta Levincha. Now, the fourth one is that on all of the nights, we eat sitting or reclining. And this night, we must recline. Now that is because of the requirement that a person should view it as though he himself had gone out of Egypt, that he attained this freedom on this night. That's the whole idea of reclining, to demonstrate that you're a Ben Chorin. The basic idea of the four questions is to elucidate the mitzvos of the night. So there are two mitzvos with regard to eating. One is the eating of the matzah, which is the idea of geula. The other one is the eating of the moror, which is the remembrance of the pain. I guess that sort of corresponds to maschal bignus u'masayim b'shevach, that we begin with the degradation and we end with praise. That in order to fully appreciate the freedom, the person has to have a sense of the opposite, how bad this, how bitter, how painful it was. So that's the first two mitzvos. That there are two mitzvos in terms of things that a person has to eat. It's interesting to note that the Torah chose to have us partake of this through eating. Food has an impact upon a person. Food is part of a person's culture. It's his way of life. So especially if you're eating something which is bitter. The matzah is kind of neutral. It's not something that a person eats because he likes it. It's kind of neutral. But the moror is bitter. That's contrary. A person's not going to eat the moror. So it's a very unique type of an eating. In a sense, it's more unique than the eating of matzah. Because matzah, I don't think it's the most tasty food. I don't think that there's too many people that are going to just say, I love to eat matzah, per se. If you like matzah, you put some butter on it and salt or cream cheese, something like that. But a person that likes bread, Person that likes bread, he likes to eat a nice bread. Yeah, people will eat French breads or whatever, different breads, because they're intrinsically satisfying. The matzah you may eat if you're hungry. But, okay. But it's not something which is negative either. It's not contrary to your feelings. But if I tell you to eat maror, that's something you will recoil from. No one's going to eat maror throughout the year. It's sort of like swallowing a bitter pill. So in that sense, the achila is more abstract and philosophical than even the eating of the matzah. Because, I mean, I'm just putting this forth right now, my own ideas. I'm testing it, so to speak. That the matzah, of course, is a halachic eating. But from a philosophical standpoint, it's not something of a person who doesn't mind eating it so much. Something that satisfies you. If you're hungry, the matzah will satisfy you. To the contrary, the maror is completely, in other words, it's barely achila, so to speak, if you have real maror. It's barely eating because it's something which is contrary. It doesn't really fill you, and you want it to be over. So, but on the other hand, from the standpoint of the mitzvah, you could see why it's a very effective, because it's purely for the sake of the mitzvah.